coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio and welcome back to Worth Doing Badly. I am Jamie Krieger, your host, and I am joined by David Weber and Ethan Stoppenhagen. And on today's episode, we will survey the lessons for the 21st Sunday after Pentecost. And they are Isaiah 45, verses 1 to 7, Psalm 96, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 1 to 10, and Matthew 22, verses 15 to 22. We begin with David Weber, followed by comments and questions from Ethan Stoppenhagen.
Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. This passage, which has generated down through the ages discussions and disputes and all sorts of things, shows the attractiveness and persuasive energy of Jesus' teachings. In this context, he is responding to a question meant to either alienate Jesus from his followers or to turn him into a seditious rebel. The question was about taxes, of course, and rather than being entrapped by the question of do you pay taxes to Caesar, Jesus used the moment to teach about the earthly kingdom and how the earthly kingdom fits into God's kingdom on earth. And he did this by asking for a coin. And then taking the coin, Jesus declared that as the money had Caesar's image, the word icon is the Greek word, because Caesar's image was inscribed on it, it belonged to Caesar, so you were to pay what you owed Caesar. And I'm sure that there was a bit of disappointment in Jesus' answer there and saying you just pay your taxes. But he went on to say that that's not an all that important concern, is the amount of taxes that people were paying, and there it was confiscatory. Jesus continued, render unto God the things of which God's image is inscribed. And God's image is inscribed on every creature and on all creation. So with that, Jesus is saying, however great you think politics and economics and Caesar are, they live within the kingdom of God on earth. And I think Luke seemed to anticipate this contrast between Caesar and God, which diminishes the power of Caesar, when he reported that Jesus was born at the time of Caesar Augustus and unsurprisingly at a time when Caesar was levying taxes, and at a time when Caesar used the threat of death to collect money. This is the contrast Luke is making. God became flesh to freely give his life, which would give life to the world. That Jesus had come to the world to restore God's image in the world. That's what salvation is depicted as. So Jesus dismissed the political and economic question of taxes because it was a small and insignificant thing compared to the gift of life that and the restoration of God's image that he came to fulfill. Now, Matthew notes that Jesus' adversaries were astonished that Jesus' teaching had such beauty to attract and such power to persuade. And then immediately they scurried off to plan Jesus' death, choosing rather to control dead things with trying to gain political and economic power and to use the power of death rather than being invited into this expansive life, this restored salvation that Jesus was promising them. And yet, as this incident indicates, the beauty and power of Christ's teachings are living signs of the life he promised to give us. And yet, there is this insidious attraction to the control of dead things that is represented by these taxes. Why is it that this desire for economic or political power seems so much more important than this offer of the restored image of God in us through Christ. And that's kind of my question, Ethan, is this passage makes the offer of salvation so attractive, it makes it so much more sweeping and superior to the pettiness of the discussion of politics and economics, and yet we are continually seduced by that power and turning away from the power of salvation. So you will set me straight on this.
I think in some ways that dead things are easier to control and to have a complete handle on living things. Now, what exactly that brings to bear on this whole conversation and what's in the Pharisees' mind, I'm not exactly sure, but that's the first thing that comes to mind.
Well, it's very clearly that they compliment Jesus' teaching in cynical ways and in explicit ways. They were astonished at his teachings.
They know he's right, I think.
And I think there was almost this attractiveness of, yes, if God actually is restoring his image, then nothing else compares to that. If salvation is really present. But then there's something about that is not attractive to them. And it's not attractive to, I think it's not all that attractive to people, because you talk of salvation generates no excitement. The talk of the restoration of God's image generates no enthusiasm, but you get people talking about economics, or you get them talking about politics, and they get red in the face and excited about it as if that's the real business of life. And I think if the one thing that's clear of this passage is that Jesus dismisses the whole question of taxation. It's unimportant almost. And that almost seems like, you know, heresy to say these things are unimportant.
It does, because I know we've talked a lot about my classmates at the university, and many of them were convinced that the way to restore the image of God in the world was through nonprofits and through political influence.
That's a good light cast on it. It's that there's a huge amount of trust that somehow being able to force people to do what they don't want to do freely, which is what politics is. It's gaining and keeping power, that's more impressive than what Christ is doing, is drawing people to his presence and the restoration of God's image in our lives. And yet for some reason that seems like a small thing. And maybe the psalm will help. So we are to render to God everything stamped with the image of God, which is everything. There's nothing that doesn't have the image of God stamped on it. And as I said, what salvation is, it's the restoration of that tarnished image. And if that is possible, if there's any chance of that kind of restoration, the psalm is ready to celebrate. And this psalm celebrates the glory of God's creation, but it treats the most important event, not the creation. The most important thing about God's presence is that a single individual who has received this salvation sings a new song. And the song is expressive of the joyfulness that the tarnished image of God is being restored. So the actual singing of any single individual will seem insignificant. And yet the psalm treats it as the sign that of the most significant thing that's happening on earth. But that insignificance of the single individual singing the new song is only on the surface. In fact, the psalm says that single voice is part of a cosmic choir made up of single voices throughout the history and throughout the cosmos. And it's those single voices each joining together in this cosmic choir, rejoicing That the heavens have been created, that rejoicing in the exultant earth, the thunderous sea, the glad fields, and the joyful trees. So on the surface, it appears that God's restoration of his image is a tiny thing compared to politics and economics. But in fact, it is all creation that is being restored. And so the readings contrast the song of salvation with the worldly fixation on the power to control a small and narrow part of creation, as you observed. And it's probably a dead part of creation. And the whole point is to try to gain control. But that control is always only for a brief period of time and of a small part of creation and with no lasting goodness. And so the proof of the powerlessness of politics and economics is that it can't bring up a single soul to sing a new song of joy. The proof of its futility is that those who collect taxes are never satisfied. Whatever that salvation is, it doesn't breed joy or contentment. So the salvation being the restoration of God's image, at least according to the psalm, the sign of its truthfulness is that the individual sings the new song. The individual joins a part of this cosmic choir, and in this thunderous praise of God's glory and greatness and grandeur.
So part of that image restoration then is it letting go of the control, the or that fixation on power? That then sort of releases the song, right? Because, you know, there's no any singing or celebrating that's done under constraint is, you know, really not true beautiful singing, I would say. So for to restore the image and to foster that flourishing, it's got to be, there's like a release of control, right?
Yeah. And that, I think, there are just so many things that play into this. I am fond of the talk of a gift economy or a grace economy. I'm not talking about a general economy that the world can work with. It's the moments in which we can bring into our lives the reality that we think is guiding the world, that God is giving us salvation, and that the gift is the one thing that is uncoercive. It's what's given, and the gift is what produces the joy. And Christians try as much as possible to bring that gift economy to bear in our lives in this world. Now, one of the things I think is hilarious in Isaiah is the way, and I think Luke does the same thing. Cyrus was an important person. He was as important or more important as Caesar. And yet, the way that Isaiah treats Cyrus is that Cyrus's kingdom is circumscribed by God's kingdom. Cyrus's kingdom will have, you know, be limited in time and reach, but God's kingdom is gaining momentum eternally. And so the way that Isaiah presents this is that God's kingdom is so much greater, it circumscribes and limits and directs the earthly rulers. Now, I think Cyrus may have bristled at Isaiah's characterization that his a great feat of ending the Babylonian Empire and the Babylonian captivity, or that Cyrus's support for the temple, the rebuilding of the temple, or the funds that he gave for the exiles to return. Isaiah presents it this, for the sake of my servant Jacob and Israel, my chosen one. That's why Cyrus was important, not because of what he was doing for his kingdom, but because he was serving God's intent to bring salvation to the world through Jacob and Israel. And so he may have wanted some additional credit rather than merely being God's anointed, chosen, and called one. And I think similarly, we can imagine Caesar bristling at Luke's suggestion that the Pax Romana's greatest achievement was to lay the groundwork so that Jesus could be born and as auxiliary to Jesus' birth, or as an aid to the spread of Christianity. Or if Caesar could have recognized that he was there preparing Rome for Christian occupation as the center of the world outreach. Of course, no one at the time would say that. Historians nowadays would not look at it that way, but that's how Isaiah looked at it. That's how Matthew looked at it. That's how Luke looked at it, that there is nothing more important than salvation, the restoration of God's image. And what will prove to be true, will be all of the earthly powers are, in a sense, in service to this movement of the restoration of God's image. And I think it's arguable that, like what Isaiah and Luke and Matthew record, that this is actually how history has shaken out. God working behind the scenes where Caesar's taxation is a small part of Jesus' intent to rescue and reclaim everybody. What Jesus saying that the real movement that matters is the restoration of God's image, and that everything else will serve this. This is what we see taking place again in the Old Testament with Cyrus and what's claimed by Jesus with Caesar.
So we would have to tread carefully, though, because we were talking about our friends who think the way to restoring the image is through political influence, and making sure that that doesn't become then the priority, right? Even if all worldly powers and dominions are now under the dominion of Christ and serving him.
I would put it much more strongly. I think we are in an age of idolatrous attachment to politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that we are in an age, now, just because I say it so clearly doesn't mean that if I actually thought that someone was thinking that. But one of the things that these passages show is that the Jesus's adversaries wanted Jesus to say the Romans were evil and the enemies. Mm-hmm. And Jesus essentially is saying, no, they are under God's control, and God will use them for his purposes. So, I mean, if Rome was evil, then giving taxes to evil would be expediting evil, and that would make Jesus a heretic. But Jesus just dodges that whole thing and that whole trap question, and rather says all of reality is stamped with the image of God, even Caesar. Reality can resist the salvation, but finally it is the movement of salvation through the gospel and not through economics and not through politics. Doesn't mean that economics and politics are utterly unimportant. They're just unimportant. And when they do become important, they become temporarily important. And I might be overstating it. I just think that when we go to Thessalonians, I think this is exactly Paul's position on he being a victim of power politics, and eventually executed because of it. He has very little interest in it. He is rather, glories in this passage about us being imitators of the Lord. He seems to be glorying at the fact that we can actually be drawn in and in a real sense be imitators of Christ. So I'll say categorically, I think Jesus and Paul were dismissive of worldly power. I think they were suspicious of it. And while taxation being the power to take another person's money against their will seemed like a really big concern, Jesus just dismissed it. While being subject to the coercive power of Rome, Paul just treated that as something much less significant than everybody else did. When compared, it's all relative to the energy of the gospel. And Paul talks about this energy of the gospel, that he says the gospel came not just as a word of promise. It was pretty powerful as a word of promise, but that word of promise turned out to be so much more than words. And Paul says that the word of promise, when it actually gets into the soul of the single individual, as we said in the psalm, that produces a song. Paul says that it produces more than that. It unleashes the energy of the Holy Spirit, and it generates a conviction. And that personal conviction, that conviction can only be experienced by a single individual, that the greatest work of God within the life is that single individual desires to imitate Jesus, who is the perfect image of God. That to see Jesus is to see see our future, and to be infatuated with that and drawn to that image of Jesus, and to that insofar, ever so imperfectly, this is one of the things that's worth doing, whether you do it well or do it badly, that imitating Jesus is worth doing, he being the perfect image of God. So the energy of the gospel increases as those who desire to imitate Christ then become examples to others. So Paul says, you want to see real power. Watch how that power of salvation changes people subtly and slowly by the promise of the forgiveness of sins, so that they imitate Christ and then become examples to others who are drawn to the image of God. And this drawn to the hope of an ongoing restoration of God's image in each one of us. Paul is utterly infatuated with that hope of the restoration of God's image. And Paul says, you want to know what incites gratitude? It is that, and Paul expresses his gratitude, how this conviction and faith is expressed in people freely doing works of love, and people who are enduring affliction in hope. Paul, what appears on the surface, that this politically marginal and economically repressed group of Christians seem to be on the outside of everything that mattered, Paul sees it considerably different. That when this group of people wants to imitate Jesus, when they freely do works of love, when they freely express their gratitude, when they endure affliction, this is what is so much more impressive than anything that political or economic power can do. This is the restoration of the defaced image of God is the one thing that the human heart desires. And Paul is utterly taken up with the fact that each one of us can be a part of that.
Thank you, David and Ethan. And thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.